Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Miracles, miracles. Okay. Thank you for that. Good morning, everybody. My name is Samba. I'm a grateful alcoholic. My home group is the Francistown Keep It Simple group of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm here with Anna and Lutwin from the group. We meet every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. in Nyangagwe Hospital. If you're in town, please do give us a visit. I have a sponsor, and I also sponsor some ladies, though not right now, not in the AA fellowship. I'm very, very grateful to be here, and I would like to thank Scott, Michelle, for your support over the years and for inviting me here and inviting me to be of service at this meeting. So where do I start? The miracles in my life, they're just too many. So for today, I'd just like to maybe focus on one of the miracles that I've experienced. And then I've also been asked to talk about the second part, faith without works is dead. Yes. So I'll just talk a little bit about the miracles in my life. I'd like to start by quoting something from the big book that talks about fear, because fear is a big thing for me, was a very big thing when I was an active alcoholic. And the big book says that we think fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause so much trouble. And from the 12 and 12 of step 7 on page 74, it says, until now, our lives have been largely devoted to running from pain and problems. That was my life. We fled from them as from a plague. We never wanted to deal with the effect of suffering. Escape via the bottle was always our solution. Character building through suffering might be all right for saints, but it certainly didn't appeal to us. So I didn't know I was an alcoholic. I used to be able to diagnose other people as being alcoholics, but I thought I had a reason to drink the way I drank. I thought I had a particular stress, difficult conditions, being a single parent, foreigner working in Botswana. I had reasons, depression. I had reasons to drink the way that I drank. Alcohol did magic for me. When I drank, I became a different person. I was no longer timid, scared, intimidated. I was very courageous, strong, bold, clever, everything. It just transformed me. It just changed me. I don't know when it started to become a problem, because in my family of origin that I grew up in, there was always drinking going on around the house. I think there's lots of generations that have died. I think they must be alcoholic. And there was always a lot of drinking, and, you know, I could drink and not get drunk. I could drink and, you know, be strong just like the men. So it never seemed to be a problem. But somewhere along the way, like others have shared, my drinking, I crossed from just being a normal drinker to becoming an alcoholic. And what used to have been my friend, in that when I drank, my anxieties, my fears were taken away from me, now just had me landing into more and more problems. When some of the fears, I'm talking about this fear, some of the fears that I have learned, that I've had, are because when I was growing up, is the way I reacted to the different things that were going on in my household. I've learned that it's not so much the fact that my parents were necessarily, you know, always fighting, drinking, whatever, but it's the way I reacted to the conditions that I was growing up around, in that I was always very fearful, because I have these memories of being a little girl on the back seat and mom and dad have been drinking all afternoon and we're driving and then they start quarreling as they always did and then dad would put his foot on the accelerator and then mom would say she was going to jump out of the car and then I'd be screaming behind and say stop, stop, but you know, they were caught in that alcoholic madness, you know, with the drinking and nobody was hearing me. And it would just go on like that, such memories. So I do remember that from an early age, I've been having these fears and anxieties that in time, it seemed like alcohol was the solution to them. But of course, I began to get into trouble with my drinking because the next day, as I was growing older and, you know, I would not be remembering what I'd been saying the night before or whom I'd been with or what I had promised. You know, by now I was a single parent. I was bringing up my children, having divorced from their father. And, you know, they'd say, oh, mom, you promised this. And, you know, I really couldn't remember promising them whatever it was. But I knew from their faces that I had said something and I'd said I would do something, but I couldn't remember what it was. There was the remorse and the guilt in the morning. And then as the years passed and my drinking was worse, you know, they'd say, you know, you change when you've been drinking. You become somebody else. We're scared of you when you've been drinking. And I knew they were telling the truth because even I was scared of me because I used to get very angry and resentful. I mean, I remember there's a time that towards the end of my drinking, my friends also said, you know, when you're drinking, you're such a problem and, you know, you shouldn't drink so much like that. And then I thought, oh, who are they to tell me? You know, it's my alcohol. I'll just drink at home. And, you know, so I'd go get, those days were those cassette things. We'd go and rent them, get home, pour myself my gin and tonic and then put the cassette in the machine. And the next thing it's morning and I don't even know. I don't have any free of those things that I never watched, but, you know, I just paid for them and I never watched. And so these things did happen, but, I didn't know how to be different. I didn't know how to live without alcohol. I didn't know how to face the world without alcohol. When the bills would come, because I was always late paying my bills and all that, I'd get nervous. I'd get this knot in my stomach, start looking at them, and then decide I'd have a drink and then sort that out. And, you know, that would be the end of it. That's how I dealt with life. That's how I dealt with bad news. That's how I dealt with everything. So I'll just fast forward that a little, and I was just getting into more and more problems, and I think the biggest thing for me was then my children were then like about teenagers and all that, and they were at school with their father here in South Africa, and I was still living in Francistown. They just didn't want to be spending that much time with me anymore. And because they said I was different and I didn't know how to be different. My friends as well, you know, and I just didn't know how to be different. And then I had some good people who had a bit of understanding that this might be alcoholism. And they organized for me to go to rehab. And I was very, very frightened because I didn't know how I could manage to go through the day without drinking. And by that stage, I was not only just drinking, I was also like putting pills and tablets, like, you know, these Valiums and things, because I couldn't always be stinking alcohol. But then when I'd be feeling funny and having that knot in my stomach, putting some pills in my system seemed to help a bit and buy me some time until I could get to my drink. And so I came to rehab in Boksburg, here in on the 30th of November 1999, and I'm grateful to say that from that day I've been separated from alcohol by God's grace. So when I was in rehab, I learned more about alcohol. I learned about alcoholism. I learned about myself. I got exposed to AA, and I just thought, you know, how do I do this? I want to be different. I want to stay sober. And they said, you know, just keep yourself sober for the next person, because there were no AA meetings in Francistown. And the only exposure I'd had to AA was in the treatment. But when I went back to Francistown, since they said you've got to change what you were doing, etc., what I did is I decided I must change what I was doing. Instead of sitting in front of the TV and playing these videos, I went and invested in a computer and dial-up internet in those days, 1999. and started connecting online and, you know, joined. We didn't have the Skype and chat sort of, but there were lots of resources online, and I made AA friends online. So I started getting connected to the fellowship online. I got a sponsor online and started working my steps through emails, etc. And that was what happened until I met the man who was to become my second husband, who was then living in the U.S., and he came out to live in Botswana in 2002, and we were able to start an AA meeting there, and he was also in recovery. And then since then, we've had our AA meeting. And it's been wonderful to see all the many miracles that I've had, but I think one of the greatest miracles for me was in 2007, my late husband, who was also in the program, he got diagnosed with cancer, with lung cancer. And that was a very, very difficult phase in my life. But I do remember that this was the first time when actually I did not want to run away from whatever it is that I had to face. And I think this is because I knew that I now was not facing things alone, and I was not being asked to face anything alone. When he was coming here for some tests and Joburg and all that, I went, looked online, phoned people, whatever, found meetings. I think that's when I met you, Scott, the first time. Yeah, so connected to the network. And, you know, it helped so much that wherever we went for tests and diagnosis and all that, to find an AA meeting, to go to the AA meeting and just listen. You know, I don't have to share whatever, but just get connected and just get plugged in, because I think God's presence is really mightily felt in these rooms. They were really very healing for me. And back in Francistown as well, having the home group was our connection. And, you know, we continued to go to meetings. And then he had to go to the U.S. at some stage for more tests and possible surgery. And there too, I went to meetings, and he was in hospital, and people brought the meeting into the hospital room, and we had an AA meeting in the hospital room. And so throughout all this time, I've just always been connected to the program. And then, in those last days when he had to walk around with an oxygen machine, we still went to meetings together. He went up the stairs with the oxygen just to be there at the AA meeting and, you know, to share, and we were together at the AA meetings. And it was just in the last weeks, you know, when he really could not move much. But I remember even on the day that he died, the 15th of November, 2008, that Saturday was a day where we had an AA meeting at the psychiatric unit. And I said, you know, today Jim's not good. He hasn't got out of bed all day. I'm not ready to leave the house. I don't have anybody to leave him with. And the guy said, okay, we'll come and have the meeting there at the house. And then they came over, and we had the meeting at the house. And he died that night, and they were so grateful that they had a chance to come and say goodbye to him. And really, through all these things, I never thought, you know, to run, to take some pills, to whatever, because it's not easy to see the person that you love so much, that you've shared so much with, going through what he's going. But with AA and with this program, it was possible. I think the greatest thing is because we were also both of us connected to the program. Whenever things were happening, we could just say the serenity prayer together. Or I remember sometimes we'd get some reports back from the laboratory, and that would say that, you know, like the cancer had come back again. And then it'd say, you know what? God knew about this before we got the results. God is still in charge. God is still on this. And, you know, just this living one day at a time, one night at a time, it brought a different kind of quality to the life that we had in those years. And I used to ask him, do you think you're suffering? And then he said, no, I don't think so. You know, there was a lot of peace and acceptance. And I think that just comes from the program. I remember there were friends who would be wanting to come and visit us, and then they'd be a bit nervous because they'd say, you know, what do we say? We know he's dying. You know, how do we talk? And then they'd come and they'd find us like normal. But this is because we're accepting, and, you know, we're just living one day at a time, and we're enjoying what we have this one day, because we trust that our higher power will carry us through whatever it is that we need to deal with. We don't have to fight or work out for these things on our own. So that was a great miracle for me. It was also a great miracle for me to give up control, trying to control outcomes, trying to know this. I am a doctor by medical training. I'm a physician, and you know, we doctors, we don't give up. We don't like go to other people when we are sick. We treat ourselves, we treat our families, you know, all those things. But this was a time in my life and my growth had arrived that, you know, other people will take care of him. I'm not going to be his doctor. I'm just going to be his wife. And you know, whatever decisions they're making, okay, that's fine. I'll go with them, etc. So this was really a gift for me, this gift of surrender and not wanting to control outcomes and how is this going to be and how is this going to be, you know, just let it be. Just trust that it will work out. And yeah, so that's the one aspect that I wanted to share, that through all that, I didn't have to drink, drug or whatever. And I could die, he could die with me holding in his arms and, you know, just crying together. And that was fine. And it's all beautiful. And for that, I'm very grateful. So that was one of the miracles that I wanted to share with. And now I've been asked also to talk about faith without works is dead. And I'm not sure whether I just wanted me to talk about working, experience of working with others. But I thought that maybe I'll just talk a little bit about the second part, from chapter 12. Where it's about, where the bottom of page 100, it says, assuming we're spiritually fit, we can do all sorts of things alcoholics are not supposed to do. People have said we must not go where liquor is served, we must not have it in our homes, we must shun friends who drink, we must avoid moving pictures which show drinking scenes, we must not go into bars. Our experience shows that it's not necessarily so. We meet these conditions every day. So I just like to share about what my life is like now in terms of being able to go out as a free person in the world. Because before, what used to happen is if alcohol called my name, then I was powerless to resist it. If the thought of alcohol, a drink, came into my mind, then my mind just started working as, how soon can I start drinking and how can I drink and get away with it? How can I drink and not get drunk and how can I drink so they won't know I'm drinking? That sort of thing. And I'm now free of that obsession and craziness. I've been able to enjoy and go to parties, weddings, etc., travel, and not feel that urge to drink or that craving to drink. I do not hang around drinking places just for the sake of hanging around drinking places. Like the big book says, I need to have my reasons for being there. So I do go to places where I've been invited and for a time, for a purpose, but I'm able to enjoy myself. I was not able to be at a party and enjoy and dance without drinking. But now I'm able to do that, and that's a gift. I'm able to stay with people and to be present and to be there in the moment without drinking, and that's a gift. And the faith without works is dead for me also translates that I also practice these principles that I've learned here in the program in my affairs with my family, in my affairs with my colleagues at work, in my affairs with my children. One of the big things that I had an experience this year of traveling, I was able to visit my adult daughter who lives in Hamburg. And previously, what she could remember, I was sober then, but what she could remember was that the last time I had visited her, she went out for 2 minutes and I'd rearranged her house while she was out. So, being in this program and growing in sobriety has taught me that I've just got to let people be. I've got no right to control them, organize them, or whatever. And there's nothing like being so-called, I'm just here to help. I'm offering to help. No. So this time, I was able to, if I want to do something, I ask permission and I say, you know, can I do this or is this okay to do this? And if she's not, doesn't want it done, just leave it, etc. But, you know, I don't assume things about my loved ones, and I don't assume that I'll be helpful by doing this for them because I'm only trying to help. I've also stopped being as demanding as I used to be, that, you know, when are you visiting me and when am I seeing you and how come you don't do this? When I have interactions with them, I am grateful for the interactions that I have with them, but I do not make demands on them as I used to, because I used to always feel sorry for myself and feel that, you know, if they were around, then I wouldn't miss them so much and et cetera. But I don't need to do that anymore because their life is their life and my life is my life. So that's really, is a great release. And, just translating this is also, you know, even in the workplace or whatever, you know, just that I'm not there to control or to direct people, but I'm there to be of service. I'm there to support and encourage people to be the best that they can be. And these are all gifts that I have learned here in the program. So I think with that, I've got nothing to share, and I'm really grateful to be here, especially that today it's my birthday. It's my Belly Burton birthday. Because, so really, I'm great. I'm 58 years old and I'm almost 13 years sober in the program, being of service. I'm really grateful for that. Thanks.
Hi, my name is Jill. I'm an alcoholic and I'm very grateful to be here. On the way here, we had quite a moment in the car. I don't know any of you who come from Johannesburg. For some reason, I am in my life where I'm accepting my downfalls, and I've accepted that I'm an alcoholic. And the one thing that I've also accepted is that I'm really bad with directions. So I have a Garmin, and I trust in that Garmin implicitly. And that Garmin tonight, for some reason, decided to take us through the Protea Ranch, which for me was very hysterical because I was wondering why we would have an AA meeting in the ranch. Now, if anybody remembers the ranch from Johannesburg, the ranch was a whorehouse. So my friend and I were driving and we were hysterical, and it was actually just such a nice feeling that I was actually taking a road trip. I was killing myself and behaving like an absolute child, and I was stone cold sober. It was really an amazing thing. 2 years ago, I used to own a cooking school, and I decided one night that it was a very good idea, because of where I was in my life, to take out my best knife, sharpen it, walk upstairs, run a hot bath, and slip my wrists. I then decided not to, but that's where I was 2 years ago. And it's actually quite amazing for me to be able to stand here, having accepted that I am an alcoholic and learning to accept what I know and what I don't know about my life and what I'm going to have to change about it. It's an amazing thing. And I think the biggest thing when I was told what I should talk about is that big acceptance thing. I probably was born an alcoholic, but couldn't quite accept it. I was one of those little kids. My parents were colonials in Malawi, and they had this beautiful, beautiful liquor cabinet with all these cut glasses and all these different bottles with different colors. And I remember probably as a child of about 4 or 5 sitting in front of that cabinet thinking, wow, it must be so amazing to be big so that you can actually drink out of those bottles and actually be allowed to touch those cut glass crystals. Of course, I wasn't an alcoholic. My birth was quite interesting, and it sort of ties quite importantly into my story. I was born in Malawi, and my father, depending on how much he's had to drink, the story gets better as it goes along. The story is it was a very dark night. There were hundreds of hyenas, as I said, depends on how much he's had to drink, and he had to drive my mother along this dark road with the hyenas attacking us to get us to hospital so I could be born. I was born a twin. My mother's convinced that my brother killed my twin on his second birthday, And it's a very big part of my story in terms of it. My brother has been in AA for 17 years, and it's been one of the reasons, because of his story, that I could never accept that I was an alcoholic, because I was never as bad as my brother. And it's a very big, important part of my story in terms of my codependency with him. Anyway, we moved from Malawi. We came back to South Africa. My childhood was pretty normal, but I never really fitted in. I always had this feeling that I was this fuddly little redhead. Being redheaded already puts you in a huge minority and makes you a huge, well, just somebody to ridicule. And probably because I didn't have the confidence to kind of grow into my red hair, I shied away from people, and I just never really quite coped with life. Junior school was not the greatest for me, because then they told me that I wasn't only fugly, I was also dyslexic and stupid. So that was a bit of a problem. I then went to high school, and I found out that I wasn't actually that stupid, and I could smell. Yeah, I am dyslexic, aren't I? I could spell better than most of the people in my class. I am one of those sort of people who like to go back to the days of school, even though I'm 45. My school days were great. I went to a convent. I did grow in a lot of confidence. At 15, I did realize that if you drank, you could probably become a lot more exciting, and a lot people found you more exciting, and I did get a lot more confidence. And I was actually reminded a couple of days ago, when I first did my share, I was trying to think back to when I started drinking and how it happened. And my best friend reminded me, "But Jill, you actually had alcohol poisoning the first time you drank." I don't remember that. I just remember jumping off the stairs saying, "I'm Superwoman," because there were a couple of guys around and they'd poured me some cane in a glass. To this day, obviously, I don't drink now, but I've never been able to drink cane again. And I thought, the cane tastes so bad, so if I put some wine in it, it won't be so bad, it'll taste better, because I couldn't admit to anybody that I couldn't drink. And apparently, as my best friend says, I did get alcohol poisoning. I sort of carried on, and I chose to go into a career which was wonderful in terms of drinking. I think I'm going to take a bit of a step back, because I need to sort of share my brother's part in all of this. My brother, in my mind, was, when I was a child, he was my big hero. As he got older, he was just an asshole who smoked too much dope and drank too much. So I never wanted to be like my brother. I didn't want to drink so much, and I didn't want to be a dopehead. So in my later years, that's where I kind of had that conflict, and I couldn't come to that acceptance that I was an alcoholic. He went off to the army, like all good South Africans did. I went on my way. I went into the hospitality industry, which was absolutely fabulous, because as a woman in the hospitality industry in the 80s, if you couldn't drink more than the guys, you weren't going to get promoted. So I remember, I was still very shy and insecure, and I remember I made a decision on the day I was a Holiday Inn trainee. And the day that I actually started my traineeship, I was walking up Sunnyside Hotel, and there was a stairway, and on one side there was a group of guys, and then the girls all sort of giggling nervously. I'm not quite sure if we're allowed to swear, but I do swear a little bit. Now, I thought, this, I'm not going to talk to the girls. I'll take all the boys out for a drink. All of those girls actually dropped out, and all of those boys who today probably still remember me. And I carried on my career in the hotel industry, very much drinking a huge amount to keep up with the guys. I was one of the first female GMs for City Lodge because I was one of the boys. When I finished my training, and it's also a thing that I went to PE Holiday Inn to become a banqueting manager. And after I was there for about 6 months, I was told by my doctor that I had cancer. Remember, I still hadn't accepted I was an alcoholic. So what I heard was, "We're going to give you treatment. You'll never be able to have children. Best you go out there, get drunk, and get pregnant." What he was actually saying was, yes, you're going to have treatment. The odds might not be in your favor that you'll be ever able to have children. But, of course, I went out. I got drunk, and I got pregnant. I was very fortunate that Holiday Inn was going through a whole phase of turning into Holiday Inn Garden Courts. And I kind of got the feeling when I came to work one day and my office had been turned into a vending machine that I might be retrenched. You can imagine how big my office was. I was really important in those days. And I was then able to be retrenched and go to Hermanus and get as large. I actually used to do all the petitions against the boats going into the bay with the whales because I was so huge. My son was born just under 5 kilograms. So you can imagine I'm not a small person, and I had this huge baby. And I kind of lived my life sort of relative sobriety for a couple of years because my son became the most important thing in my life. And then I moved back to Johannesburg, and I thought maybe I should think about getting a man, but do I really want to bother? At 15, I'd always sworn that there's absolutely no way I'm going to have children because I'm not going to F them up like my parents F me up. I duly had 2 children. But I thought maybe I should sort of think about a husband. So I started a job, and my boss's secretary invited me to go to Pretoria. At the time, I had this little blue beetle that I'd driven to Mafeking and all around the country with my son next to me in it. And I went out, my little blue beetle, and any of you people like the Twilight movies? Hands up, you can admit it, we're at an AA rally. It's acceptance, okay? Come on, girls! Okay, I'm going to paint the picture. Think sort of a club, smoky lights, and there's this guy in the corner. Looks a bit like a vampire with long, dark hair, very chiseled cheekbones, and this sort of thing. You with me, hey? Anybody who's ever had fantasies about vampires, I was done. I was completely done. I saw this man, and I thought, this is it. And of course, we were off to a good start because he apparently had big things about women with red hair, and at that time I had quite long red hair. So it was a match made in heaven because he bought me a Springbok and I was his. I did, of course, say, you know, I do have a son, and you've got to accept me and my son. And me, again, not an alcoholic, took a bet with him that he wouldn't phone me. I was quite desperate. I really wanted him to phone me. So I took a bet with him that I would take him out for dinner if he did phone me, and he phoned me the next day. This man is a Polish guy, and just in terms of our relationship, the first time that I slept over at his house, remember, single mom, counting the pennies, woke up in the morning, and I thought, okay, do I get all the ingredients, make him breakfast in bed? Or do I go and buy a bottle of vodka, some celery, and tomato juice? We all know, because I still hadn't accepted I was an alcoholic, what I did. He, of course, loved me and thought I was the greatest thing, and all his Polish friends thought I was the greatest thing on sliced bread. And 6 months after that, on Valentine's Day, it was leap year, I asked him to marry me. If I look back now, he was an alcoholic from the day I met him. I don't think for the first 3 months of our, well, he moved in after a month. For the first month of our dating, I don't think he was ever sober. But I chose to kind of look past that. On our honeymoon, I was feeling a little bit queasy, and I was still told that the chances of having children would be very little. I had had cancer and had treatment in between again. I was never expecting to have another child, and lo and behold, I was pregnant with another child. So this poor man had this, not an alcoholic wife, a 2-year-old little boy, and a new baby girl. Our marriage was very much based on parting. When I met my parents-in-law, because I'm not Polish, they sat me down, they brought out the bottle of vodka, sat on the table and looked at me. I'm not an alcoholic, so of course I drank just as much as they did. Don't really remember going home. What I do remember, though, was when I was leaving, my mother-in-law gave me this list, and on the list was a whole lot of things what I should do to increase his sperm count, and, you know, things like wear comfortable underwear and keep the body temperature correct. And I walked to the car, and I'd had a bit of vodka, and I thought, no, I'm imagining this. And I got to the car, and my naive husband said to me, what happened? And I said, no, this is what she gave me. She said, well, she likes you. The last girl, she gave a whole list of contraceptives. So you're okay. So obviously I'd been able to drink enough vodka, and I was well on my way. The beginning of my marriage was kind of, it was, it wasn't. It was dysfunctional probably right from the beginning. I knew I had three children right from the beginning. And I coped very much in the beginning, but things started to become too overwhelming for me. And one of the reasons why I drank when I was younger was that alcohol gave me that escape. And I started my own business, and it was a business that was reliant on government funding. So often my husband would come home, and he'd know that I hadn't been paid, and I'd had to pay my staff, and I'd probably got 2 cents to my name, and that was including the overdraft was gone. And I was sitting on the patio drinking a bottle of, or probably my second bottle of white wine. And I think that's when it kind of started building up, that I found alcohol was a way for me to escape the realities of my life, that it gave me that window period where I actually didn't have to be the responsible adult in the family, and I didn't have to do anything. I could actually just get drunk and have fun. It was not a problem because all our friends were Polish, and you kind of walk into their house and the first thing they do is give you a tot of vodka. My children to this day find it quite strange that I've now moved on and I don't have a bottle of vodka in my freezer. You know, it's just not a normal thing. They grew up believing that's the most important thing in the body, in the freezer. Through this period, my brother came back into my life. Before I got married, he joined AA, and he came to my wedding, and I actually said, "Where's my brother? I've got this asshole," because he brought his Bible, and he was quoting things out of the Bible, and I was thinking, Jesus, if this is what AA does for you, he lost all sense of humor. He just wasn't really pleasant at all. And I thought, okay, well, I'm definitely never going to be an alcoholic because I'd like to keep my sense of humor. It's quite important to me. And he carried on, and my brother's been sort of in and out of my life during the rest of my sort of marriage. And he on occasion did mention to me that maybe I had a problem. And the one occasion he did mention it was when my ex-husband met my mom. We'd driven through the night because of my little boy, and we drove into Amanus, and the first thing he took out of the boot was the box of booze, you know, because all our holidays was the kids' toys and stuff would probably have to go if we couldn't fit the booze in the boot. We were always that kind of holiday makers. And he kind of sat down and he poured himself some vodka. My brother, who's just joined AA, was standing there, and my mother, and you could see them, and my mother said, "Would you like a cup of tea?" And he said, "No, I'm fine." And my brother got out that pamphlet, you know, "Do you know if you're an alcoholic?" Tick all those things. But I wasn't ready to be an alcoholic yet. I carried on with my life. I opened a cooking school, which was probably the biggest addiction in terms of my life. It was something that I was really good at. And again, because I wasn't an alcoholic, what I would do is, it wasn't a cooking school for chefs, it was a fun cooking school. So when you walked into my cooking school, the first thing that I did was I gave you a vodka dawa. You'd have to drink that before you're allowed to start cooking. Then you'd go into my kitchen and I'd help you cook, and you could have as much wine as you possibly wanted to consume, or whatever you wanted to consume. And people loved me. I hadn't realized that it was probably because they were so pissed, that's when they hugged and kissed me and they left. But it was a business that I truly, truly loved, and I probably spent far too much time on that business and not my family, and I kind of had a bit of a gap with that, and I know it had a huge, big impact on my ex-husband and my children. Unfortunately, also, what happened in terms of my story was that my best friend who started my business got divorced during that period, found internet dating, and found herself a husband who decided that drugs were quite a good thing. So unfortunately, we got told about drugs at the sort of age of 40, which was quite a big thing for us because we were quite prim and proper, didn't understand any of those things. And that became a huge, big thing in terms of my life going forward, because my ex-husband found that the drugs made him powerful and beautiful and confident, all those things that I found alcohol did for me. And it really was the beginning of the end for our relationship. And I started to drink more. The more I worked, the more I drank. And last year in September, well, what happened was I got divorced first. And because the one thing that I could accept, and that day when I was actually lying in my bath with my very sharp kitchen knife, the one thing I could accept was that I was insane, and that I always did those same things where I did the same thing and expected a different outcome. And the reason why I was in that bath was because I divorced my husband and then promptly spent a whole year going back and forth. And then after a year, actually got back together with him again. Not an alcoholic, hey? Haven't accepted this yet. And in part, in terms of making a commitment to our marriage, I sold my business. And it really was the beginning of my rock bottom. Because I lost this thing that made me feel brilliant and loved and amazing and wonderful without the use of alcohol and drugs. And I went through a very bad period where I just lost my own self-worth. And at the same time, my mother, who lives with me, fell and broke her leg. And it's quite horrific to think that I used to have to get up in the morning and drink coffee tequila because I had to bath her. And I drank coffee tequila because I don't drink tea or coffee, and I believe nobody would know that I was drinking the tequila because they'd smell the coffee on my voice or my breath. I see I'm carrying on too much. Where I'm getting to is I could not accept I was an alcoholic because my ex-husband was an alcoholic, my father was an alcoholic, my mother was not, my grandparents were, and I just refused to believe it until April of this year, where I actually thought, you know what, I am an alcoholic. And I went to a meeting, and I'd actually timed it so my brother would not be there. What happened? He walked in. And it really has been the best 7 years of my life. As I say, if I can laugh with a friend in my car, trips used to freak us out. We'd have to have a drink before we got in the car on a family holiday, and we'd drink all the way on holiday. I got in the car today, I laughed myself to death, and I'm really, really happy I'm an alcoholic. And I'm really, really grateful to be here. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.